This is J. Lewis Mills, and you are about to be put on the level with J. Lewis Mills. Whether it's truth, controversy, good news, or bad. If it offends you, I'm sorry. If you agree, that's great. We talk about it all here because everything needs to be put on the level. Come in and join the conversation. I promise you'll be glad you did. What's up, everybody? You got me, J. Lewis Mills, and we are here on the level with J. Lewis Mills. Well, this is a pretty big, pretty festive week for everybody, right? We are getting ready. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, or like I always like to call it, the day that it's okay to unbuckle your belt for seconds. Tomorrow is going to be a day that we can all be thankful about. We've had a pretty interesting year so far, and we are all still here to tell that story. So we can be thankful that tomorrow we are going to be with family, we are going to be with friends, even if you're not in the same city. You know, we will be able to speak to our family and speak to our friends over so many different social media platforms. So just be thankful that you will still be able to reach out to your family members. And also this week, this is the last week of what I have kind of called the Hollywood Controversy Series. It started a couple of weeks ago with my good friend Amy Brenneman. And then last week, we spoke with another good friend of mine, Alexander Rodriguez. He's an on-air personality, host of On the Rocks on the UBN network. This week, I wanted to end it, but I wanted to end it in a pretty interesting way. you know, I had Amy on because she could give opinions from different sides of different fences, writer, producer, actress, as well as woman. I had Alexander on because he could give his opinions from two different sides, from two different fence sides, one being a on-air personality and performer in this town, and the latter being a person, a well-known person in the homosexual community, because last week we were speaking directly about Kevin Spacey and how he brought into his explanation how he was gay. So this week, to end the series, I thought, you know, I would like to speak to someone that I don't really have that much of a history with, so our conversation will absolutely be organic. And this is also going to be someone that can give an opinion from two sides of a fence. From the side of just normal, everyday American life, American thought patterns, as well as someone that is new to the film industry. So it'll be very interesting to hear what an up-and-coming filmmaker has to say about the industry, the state of the industry that they are just now entering. And I am very happy and once you hear our conversation, you'll understand why I'm saying I'm honored to have my guest this week, Mr. Colin Bishop. Colin is a person, I'll let Colin explain to you exactly what his background is, but Colin comes from a background of politics, and now he is an up-and-coming filmmaker with a couple of projects on the horizon, one being a film that he has coming up in January by the name of Snaggletooth. So I wanted to bring Colin in order to have this conversation tonight. And just, you know, so you, my listeners, you got a very professional opinion between myself and Amy and myself and Alexander. You know, let's do the up-and-coming opinion. So, Colin, thank you very much, man, for being here. I greatly appreciate it. And how are you?
Oh, I'm great, J. Lewis. Thank you for having me on tonight. I really am honored to be part of this series and excited to be on a level with J. Lewis tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. So with you coming into, and you might want to move your mic away a little bit.
Oh, okay.
But with you coming into, you know, this industry, I mean, we'll get into the political part of your background, but with you coming into this industry, what was your first opinions when you first started hearing this the beginning of October with Harvey Weinstein? And not just that, Colin, but with so many more people that have come out or that have been exposed, most recently Charlie Rose earlier this week. So what is your opinion coming in as a new up-and-coming filmmaker to the state of this industry today?
Well, that's a great question. I guess the first thing I would say is I was just astonished about how just the level, I'm trying to like pick the right words here to describe Harvey Weinstein. I mean, it's like pervasive rape and yes. abuse spanning decades. And the number of people who knew was just flabbergasting to me. And the reason is that, you know, in my life, I've found every industry I've worked in, you know, sexual harassment has existed and even in some instances been pervasive. But the number one takeaway for me was I was just blown away that it's so bad in for so long and so many people knew and yet Harvey Weinstein was allowed to continue. And we've seen that pattern over and over in some of like Kevin Spacey, for example. I mean, it's not three people coming forward. It's 20 at a time from the theater in London. So that was what was most astonishing to me about the Weinstein scandal and just the way that it is cascaded is the icons who are being toppled were just outrageous in how far over the line they were.
Was there ever a time for you that, and again, as I said, you're up and coming and this is all fairly new, but is there a time now where you're saying, hey, maybe this isn't the town for me. Maybe there's just too much corruption here.
Well, I think that's the really great news. The old Hollywood business model was already collapsing. We all have now in our pockets the ability to make movies and to record. And so technology has totally democratized filmmaking. And you can, continue to upgrade. And then you've got YouTube and Facebook. So there are channels for distribution. So anybody who can make interesting content can find an audience. So what's really exciting to me about this moment, frankly, is the Harvey Weinsteins of Hollywood. And maybe this is a naive thing to say, but I don't think we need them anymore. And probably haven't needed them for a while. So I'm really excited to be starting a filmmaking career in this moment alongside, frankly, lots of other amazing filmmakers who are also making great work and there's space for them to find an audience and to sell their films and have being part of Hollywood pay the bills, which is a pretty big dream to have, but it's possible for a lot more people now, I think, than it may have been before.
Do you think, and this might be an unfair question to ask you because you are up and coming, however, I'm going to ask it anyway. do you think that with the comings out that have happened, as far as producers and let's just be clear, Harvey Weinstein's not the only, person behind the scenes. You've got Brad Ratner, that he's a pretty well-known director, producer as well. And, people are coming out saying that he has assaulted them. But do you think with the comings out of the elite in Hollywood that there is going to soon be a power shift, so to speak, in order to give more people like yourself, more up-and-comers, and more, I'm just going to say it, but also more female directors an opportunity to come out and do their work? Or do you think you'll still have some of the same struggles, you just won't have to worry about sexual harassment?
Well, just a couple quick things. I think sexual harassment is going to be a problem for a long time. It is pervasive in our culture. This whole story started with Harvey Weinstein, but is now impacting members of Congress. Allegations against the president have resurfaced.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to start to see people in other industries, CEOs, who get toppled. But I think that the devaluing and of women and the abuse that's taken place is like entrenched, unfortunately. So I think this is a welcome shift, but I think as a culture we have a lot of work to do. And I think that, frankly, it's not just about women. It's the same, structural, or I should say the same infrastructure and, frankly, white patriarchy that thinks it, the Brett Ratners of the world who think they can get away with treating women a certain way. I mean, that same attitude extends to people of color, LGBT Americans, all the way on down. So I think that there's a larger conversation that our country is really struggling to have openly. Mm-hmm. The sexual misconduct, it's the most salacious part. So it's getting more media attention, but it's part of a larger problem that we have as a country that we're just confronting. And, we'll have to just see how it plays out.
What is your, just frankly output putting it, what is your opinion? Your just flat opinion of the goings on in Hollywood right now that are coming out. How do you as a person feel? How does that hit you? How does that resonate with you?
I am overjoyed. My experience, and I'm a white male, but I owe a considerable bit of my career because women who worked a lot harder to climb the ladder hired me when I was young and trying to get a foot in the door. And, I'm making this film Snaggletooth, but I've been fortunate to work with, some amazing filmmakers, Maria Mieya, who's directing Bring Me an Avocado. Denishka Esterhazy, a Canadian filmmaker, she just finished principal photography on Level 16. And I guess I'm combining two things here, but the first piece of this is that these people have got to go. Mm-hmm. The Kevin Spaceys of the world. And I will just say as an aside, I am in three episodes of House of Cards. And Kevin Spacey did sign my guitar on set, which was very kind of him to do. But there was, this sort of, and I was a background actor, so I wasn't interacting with, with Kevin in a major way. But I just, good riddance is what I say, because there are a lot of really talented people who've been making great work for a long time and getting stomped on by the Brett Ratners and Harvey Weinsteins of the world.
I feel like I kind of sensed something in your tone of voice. Was there an uncomfortable tone or an uncomfortable atmosphere on set when you were on set with Kevin, even if you didn't have that close of a of dealing with him, was there still a bit of a something in the air?
Well, so I appeared in, it was interesting. So I was approached, I was living in DC at the time, was approached by someone in the casting department who originally wanted me to play a Secret Service agent. Okay. Because I'm relatively tall and they wanted a, this is a short wind up. And I showed up to be fitted to be a Secret Service agent and they said, sorry, but you have politician hair. you're playing a senator. So I showed up, I did the 2 days and an episode as a senator, and it was very exciting and got to interact on set with Kevin, and then was asked back. And when I was asked back, I just kind of, I guess, had the nerve to send an email to his assistant. And I said, hey, look, you know, this will sound crazy, but I've had, you know, three bosses in Washington, D.C. One of them is the Secretary of Energy. One of them is Barack Obama. And the third is Kevin Spacey. And, you know, the Secretary of Energy, Steve Chu, and Barack Obama have signed my guitar. Kevin is the only one who's missing. Would he sign it? And so the assistant, it took like 10 minutes. He replied, said, sure, bring it in. So I brought the guitar in and, you know, we're on set. And it was I was in this episode playing a state representative from Missouri, and it was a party scene. And there are about 80 of us packed into this little room, all with our fake wine. It was white grape juice.
Yeah.
And once they got everybody in position and we're all in our suits and it's, you know, feels like it's 90 degrees in this room, one of the producers comes in and says, which one of you is Colin Bishop? And I raise my hand and says, Kevin will see you. And so I, you know, ran and got my guitar, went to see Kevin. And you know what? He could not have been more gracious. He said, you know, I introduced myself. And he said, well, you know, tell me, how long have you been playing the guitar? And I said, well, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean to give you the impression that I play the guitar, because I don't. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, you're not the vice president.
Yeah.
he was very cool about it. But I mention all of this up front because then when I walked back into on set, where the other actors were waiting, there was clearly an impression that, you know, it wasn't like, and of course they don't know that I showed up with my guitar or anything, but there was that atmosphere. But a joke was made about it.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, someone said, well, where were you? And I said, well, you know, I was talking to Kevin to see if I could get a line.
Oh.
And, you know, someone said, you know, well, you know, and made an obscene gesture about what it takes to get a line. And a woman in another actress in the back said, that's bull. And she yelled and said, and everyone turned and looked at her and she said, I know for a fact lines cost more than that.
Oh, wow.
So it was, that was my story on set of House Cards. But I will say that the crew could not have been more professional. And that was a well-run set, and I felt very fortunate to be part of the show.
Well, I mean, it's to me that's most interesting, just because, and I guess I should just understand, a joke is a joke, and sometimes people make jokes not understanding what type of truth is there. But however, with I mean, just seeing the whole thing in my own head, just seeing you, because I've seen you and I know what you look like. So just seeing you going into a room to meet with Kevin, or going into his trailer to meet with Kevin Spacey, I mean, with all the info that is coming out now, it's just kind of funny. I wonder if people are like, You know, that guy did take a guitar in his trailer.
Well, to be fair, I didn't go into his trailer, and he had his assistant was with him the whole time. Look, the main disappointment for me is that he wouldn't take a picture with me. But you know,
you didn't give a reason why.
He didn't trust that I wouldn't put it on social media before the episode aired.
Okay, I can understand that. I have to say,
I understood it too. And look, I at no point did I feel uncomfortable. I just, it's when I got back into the room and someone made a joke, and it was a funny joke. Yes. But the crowd, like 80 people, roared with laughter. and of course now, with all the new context we have, it, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, yeah. So you, not really just to, okay, so you'll understand there's very few times or very few episodes that I will actually take a break. Usually this would be a time maybe for a break and then we would come back to a whole different subject, but since me and Brakes just aren't friends right now, we just keep going with our conversation. So I just want to kind of change the conversation to ask you. You come from a background of politics. You just mentioned that one of the people that you worked for is Barack Obama, which I just have to tell you, just side note, that just makes me more honored to have a conversation with you, just to know that you were someone of a particular caliber that someone of the caliber of Barack Obama would want in his administration. So complete kudos to you for that. But coming from working in politics to the degree that you did, I'm sure there were some things that you got to see or hear that the normal, average, everyday American doesn't get to hear. So I'm not asking you to reveal anything, but I am asking you, how many similarities do you see so far in your early career as a filmmaker in the film industry as you saw in the political arena?
The similarities between our just politics in this country and Hollywood are significant. And I'm happy to discuss some specific examples, because some of the politicians I worked for, their misbehavior has become public and it is well known. But I think for this broader conversation on sexual misconduct, the part that just has really hit home for me the most is my own failing, frankly. And that is that I, was just aware and continue to be aware of, you know, it's not like I'm in the room when something improper is happening, but people know. A lot of people know, and it's not always 100% obvious, but if you have any street smarts at all, you can put two and two together pretty quickly. And even as recently as when the Harvey Weinstein, just a quick example, when the Harvey Weinstein thing broke, I jumped on Twitter immediately and wrote something about, I can't wait for this to hit Congress. Bring the whole apparatus down. It's gross. And I wrote it, I posted it, not exactly that phrasing, and then about 5 minutes later, I deleted it. And I've spent, in the past couple of weeks at a few different points, just kind of thinking about my own unwillingness to just call out how nasty and pervasive the sexual misconduct that I was around really was. And, and so I guess what I would say in terms of a parallel between Hollywood and Washington, D.C., for example, as much as I am just astonished hearing how terrible what the actions that, and just, I'm just like floored at how outrageous these human beings are. At the same time, based on my own experience, I can understand how it's hard to just step forward and, you know, and just, yeah, and just be like, hey, this has got to stop. This is, I mean, like, you will, particularly when I was like really working for members of Congress, I mean, that's the end of your career, full stop.
Yes.
And I had some, I worked for one congressman who had, was dating multiple women, in addition, and, you know, on the side, and he would take women who were not his wife, to events and introduce them as his wife, because people would just assume that it was, and it was easier than, you know, pretending that they were just a friend or something like that. And I remember it fell to me to sit down with this congressman after, you know, word started to, about his behavior started to get out. And I said, you know, Congressman, I have good news for you. Like, your behavior is so outrageous. No one will actually believe that this is what you're really doing. They will think it's fake news because you are so outrageous. But the bad news is everyone's going to believe you're having an affair. So you just, you know what? People fail at love. You need to get a divorce, issue a 3-sentence statement, and, you know, move on with your life. But this behavior has got to stop. And he told me to get lost. So actually, he said something other than that. but we no longer work together after that.
Okay, so just to dive in. Well, there's two separate questions I want to ask, but my first question is, how is it possible for a senator of a state in the United States of America to go from event to event or party to party? I don't care if it's in a different state. How is it possible to show up at different events with different women and say that each individual woman is your wife, and somebody say, wait a minute, I was just at said event in said city or said state, and you introduced somebody different? How does somebody of prominence, I guess is my question, being a senator, how does somebody of prominence actually pull that off to the point that it's even a thing to do?
Well, it's in the last 10 years, it's become much more difficult. So I guess the first thing I would note is this, when I really was working for members of Congress was before 2000, like up through 2007 and part of 2008 before I started.
Okay.
So some of this stuff is before there was social media and everyone had a camera in their pocket. So that's, but part of it really, and I'm sure it is the same personality type, in both with these guys in Hollywood and these guys, in the Senate and the House in Washington, D.C. They think they can get away with anything. They are, the law doesn't apply to them. The rules of society don't apply to them. That's why when we hear these stories about these guys insider trading or taking flights on jets and stopping off at some, like, you know, island in the Caribbean to have a party before coming back to Washington, D.C., I don't think it occurs to them that what they're doing is outrageous and unethical and they shouldn't be doing it.
I think it's just the thing.
Well, I think that it's a symptom of a broken system. And in the case of politics, we have, over time, the way that we elect our representatives has evolved to favor, frankly, really gross people who either already have a lot of money or are wired in such a way that they are willing to do whatever it takes to get money and to manipulate people in order to, gain power for themselves. And now, and I should say, this isn't true of everyone by any stretch, but we do see some really unfortunate behavior.
Do you think that as far as politics, as well as Hollywood, do you think if these were congresswomen, and do you think if Harvey Weinstein was Henrietta Weinstein, if Kevin Spacey was Catherine Spacey, do you think the level of, do you think it would be seen as sexual harassment, sexual misconduct? Do you think it would be, do you just think it would be as seen as bad if it were women versus if it was the other way around?
I guess I just don't. Every once in a while you see a story in the news about, and usually it seems like it's a high school teacher who's a woman who's like sleeping with her 16-year-old student. But I just have to tell you, I was fortunate to be an intern for Nancy Pelosi, who's now the leader of the House Democrats. I mean, she is an astonishingly impressive person. Congresswoman Ellen Tauscher, who later was an undersecretary of state for nonproliferation, she used to, and I was her kind of her body man. And so in politics, you know, all these elected officials, they have a person who's just like with them all the time and keeps track of the schedule. And, you know, the first time I was ever in the newspaper, it was standing next to Congresswoman Ellen Tauscher holding her purse. But she had this line about Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire. And she said, look, everybody gives Fred Astaire so much credit for being an amazing dancer, but Ginger Rogers had to do everything Fred did backwards and in high heels.
Yes, that's true.
And I just have to say that the women I met in the years I worked in Washington and on campaigns, really almost without exception, worked harder. They put the time in, both with their constituents on the issues, and it made them better at their jobs. And there are some men like that, but not the majority.
Yes, and I can definitely echo that. And you did speak on something else that I can 100% agree with. You said that, you know, there are a lot of women that helped you get to the place that you are and that helped form your career. And I can absolutely say the same thing. I have had and I still currently today have some very dynamic women in my life. Do I believe that this is even a situation that could happen reversed as I asked you? No, I don't. I just wanted to get your opinion on what you thought if it were switched around, how it would be. But I absolutely 100% co-sign that thought pattern. When I had Amy on, I was talking to her. You know, she was an executive producer of my show, one of our producing director. Her name is Allison Liddy Brown. She also directs a lot of the Scandal episodes. One of the most powerful women I've ever met. The most, other than my grandmother, but the most powerful woman that I've ever met in my life was Dr. Magliotto, you know, and she's one of the top thoracic heart surgeons, not only in the U.S., but in the world. So just imagine what type of work ethic it takes for these women to be at the top of their game in a male-dominated whether it's Congress, whether it's politics, whether it's this industry. Just imagine the level of work ethic that it takes for these women to show just how dynamic they are. So I absolutely applaud 100%. So getting to my next question, This is just a completely political question. Do you mind explaining to me and my guests? I'll ask it like this. How did it come about that you started working for President Obama? And will you ever ask President Obama to be in one of your films?
That is a great question. So I should say that I have, President Obama did appoint me to the job in his administration that I held at the Department of Energy for, just under 3 years. But we only met three times. Okay. And we shook hands one time. A second time we met was maybe one of the most embarrassing moments of my life.
Oh, wow.
I was invited, long-standing dear friend of mine who worked in the White House directly for the president. She was invited to a going away party for another senior official, and she needed a plus one. And she called me up and she said, look, I want to wear this dress and these high heels. So you're going to, and she did. She bought the tie. She's like, you're going to wear this tie and you're going to be my date. And that's all there is to it. So we went to this, nice house in DC, and a lot of people from the press corps and kind of the DC, famous, the folks that you see on the Sunday talk shows and that sort of thing, Wolf Blitzers and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm not comfortable in that environment. And I worry, just as an aside about being in Hollywood, some of the kind of hobnobbing and the sort of fake, conversations, and sometimes we all just have to do that. You show up and you put a smile on and you're at the premiere, and that's part of the job. But on this particular night, I was in over my head, and so I just stood by the hors d'oeuvre table, and I have to tell you, at this party, the hors d'oeuvres were amazing.
I bet they were.
In particular, there were these little Caesar salad cones. And the cone was made out of Parmesan cheese. It was baked. And then they stuffed the Caesar salad in a little cone. Excuse me. And so I just stood in off to the side of this party by the table and was, eating these little Caesar salad cones two at a time, having a blast at the party. And I could see everyone in the room. And so I've been there about an hour, and suddenly everyone stops talking all at once. And they all turn and stare directly at me. Yeah. And I don't understand what's happening. These are, people who, to me at the time, were famous because they were, worked directly for the president or worked for NBC or CBS or Fox or whatever. And so I was intimidated and I didn't know what was going on. And so there was just sort of a beat. And then someone put their hand on my shoulder and said, mind if I get in there? And it was the president.
Oh, wow.
The Secret Service had brought him up a back door, a back entrance with no windows or anything. And this was the special entrance for the president. And I just, without realizing it, had parked myself in front of it so that I had direct access to all the food. And the president comes through the door and just sees, some kid standing there stuffing his face. So I have a mouthful of Caesar salad, and the president, makes his joke, and everybody laughs. And he says, no, really, tell me your name again. And with my mouth full of Caesar salad, I paused and forgot. So I just said, thank you, Mr. President. And the whole room laughed. And, that was the second time I met Barack Obama. So even though I worked for him, I would probably need to rely on a friend to get the script in his hands.
That should be the script. That should absolutely be it. You should definitely do a short film about that, and you should, because, I mean, he definitely would remember it. I mean, Colin, man, that's the script, man. You've got to write that. You've got to send it to him. And when you actually do it, you have to let me play a Secret Service guy just because the idea came up on the level with J. Lewis Mills.
That's a deal. 100%.
Okay. Did you ever have much dealing with Michelle Obama? Did you ever meet Michelle?
Well, that's a really interesting story. I did. So I went to graduate school at the University of Chicago from 2003 to 2004. And at the time, Barack Obama was a professor there and a state senator, and he was running for the Senate in Illinois. And he was already kind of a celebrity in Chicago. But Michelle was an administrator over at the hospital. And after I graduated, I worked for a time at the Art Institute of Chicago, and I was in charge of the fashion show, which is a story for another time. It was wild. But then I got hired back at the University of Chicago and was like a junior, lowest person on the totem pole administrator. And the university had these like larger administration conversations, and Michelle participated. And so we would, you know, we interacted in a very limited way, but I mean, for my money, Michelle Obama is so astonishingly impressive and just smart and capable, and Barack is okay, but Michelle is amazing. And so I understand when people say Michelle should be president, Michelle should do this or that. I mean, it's because she's awesome. So if I have a little pang of regret about the time I spent in Washington, it's that I didn't have the juice to weasel my way onto her team, because I think that would have been an experience like no other. And so for my friends out there who did get to work for Michelle, now you know I am enormously jealous of you.
Now, was there ever a time since you worked with her previous to her being the first lady, was there ever a time you had a chance to speak to her after she was the first lady and remind her, or did she know who you were? Or did you just not have any dealings while she was the first lady?
We really didn't cross paths while she was first lady. So the Obama's lives changed, and this, you know, comes up in their interviews, but dramatically. Yes. Once Barack Obama became president. And so, and also it's because, like, you know, suddenly everybody is their friend and whatever. And so I understand that they really, it was the close-knit people, the people who were with them from the very beginning, who lived on the South Side in Hyde Park and were their people. It makes sense to me that though that was the core that was with them and now, you know, continues with them today. And my, you know, so I had worked for, I was a you know, kind of a lifer.
Yes.
There are, when someone is elected president, you know, a lot of people work for the campaign, but for the most part, people on the campaign, you know, aren't, you know, career or haven't worked on lots of other political campaigns before. Mm-hmm. They're drawn to the particular candidate and the opportunity. They quit their jobs. They move across the country. They sleep on a little mattress in Iowa because they believe, well, not just, you know, Barack Obama might be president. And I'll just say, most of the people who make that choice are losers.
Yeah. All the
for president. So even though I love the Obamas and you know, love my friends who worked for President Obama, I do bristle a little when I hear people say, oh, that person worked for Obama, you know, he or she must be a genius. It's like, well, actually, you find the kid in Iowa who convinced 60 Iowans that Chris Dodd was going to be the next president of the United States. There's your genius.
Yeah, there you go.
Like the rest of us are just very fortunate. You know, I mean, Barack Obama is a once in a generation political figure. And so he did all the heavy lifting, I would say, or certainly a great deal of it on that campaign.
If Michelle did run for president in 2020, would you try and be on her team? Would you make an active attempt to be on her team?
Probably not. Not because I wouldn't support her candidacy, but because I've made a decision to focus on being a filmmaker. And okay. The reason I was drawn to politics was because I wanted to make an impact. And I, you know, during the, I have three brothers who are all former, or I have four brothers, three of which are either current or former military. Two did tours in Afghanistan. And, you know, just during the George Bush's presidency, I felt like the country was adrift. And so I wanted something different. And so I was totally committed to that. You know, when I was younger, I tried to do some comedy writing and, you know, tried to work, do some TV, and nothing really, panned out. So I went all in. I was like, you know, we're going to get more Democrats in Congress, and then we're going to win back the White House. And those things happened. And, you know, I was like a dust mote.
Yeah. Okay.
I had a small little role that contributed, but two things I think that I learned. One is, I think that was important work, but also I learned just how powerful storytelling is and how powerful the media is, and decided, you know, I can do more and have a bigger impact. And even though Snaggletooth is, you know, is a silly monster movie, in the long run, I think that I can still make an impact, and actually a bigger impact, through filmmaking and storytelling. So I will, send Michelle Obama money, and I will wish her well, but I'll keep plugging away on whatever film I'm working on at the time.
Okay. And this kind of brings me into my next question. So we're also getting to the end of our conversation. So I wanted to get this question in. You kind of answered it a little bit, but you can go a little deeper if you would like to. Why filmmaking after politics? Like what was the spark that made you say, okay, I'm done with this era of my life. I want to go into something else. I want to do filmmaking.
Well, I guess I should say it's not a total clean break. So I, as a result of when President Obama was first elected, I was offered a job at the Department of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I was not able to take that job because I admitted that I had smoked pot previously. And it was a really humiliating thing for me. My grandma had heard, oh my gosh, the president offered you a job. That's amazing. And she was so proud. And then I had to tell her that I didn't get the job because of drugs. And even though it had been years previous, and it was before I saw the movie Team America, which I think everybody should be stoned for, it was kind of a dark time personally, just because I felt like I'd let my family down and really blown a big opportunity. But it opened a new door, and that was to start working on energy efficiency and renewable energy, particularly for low-income families for whom their energy costs are a big deal. So I did that for two different nonprofits, and that's what I did when I worked for the president and Secretary of Energy, which is just extraordinarily satisfying work. And I left the administration. I'm still doing that work here in the U.S. and also in South Africa. And that work is actually what pays the bills. I haven't sold a film yet. But I imagine you, and probably every artist, Jay Lewis, has this where you reach a point where you just know.
Yes.
Even though people in your life tell you it's crazy, yes, that you're throwing away the correct path. No, you have a good career. You're risking everything. What if? And my only answer is I can't not do this. Mm-hmm. And I can't not make films.
Yes.
The people I've been fortunate enough to meet have changed my life. Mm-hmm. And I want to keep working with those people.
Yes.
And meet more. And, screw the Harvey Weinsteins of the world. We don't need them.
Yeah.
There are exciting stories being told every day. And, the business model's shifting. And so maybe, not everybody gets to be a gazillionaire like Quentin Tarantino, even though they have an amazing story to tell. But their stories can still be told and their movies can be found hopefully on Amazon Prime or...
Yeah.
At various places, but that's the future I'm looking forward to, really elevating my friends who are filmmakers and working with them periodically if I've got an idea and we're able to put the pieces together to give it a shot.
And in closing our conversation, I spoke about it in my introduction of you, and you have spoken about it a couple of times in our conversation. What can you tell my listeners about your upcoming project, Snaggletooth? What would you like to tell my listeners?
Well, I would love for your listeners to follow Snaggletooth on Instagram, Snaggletooth Movie, and Twitter, Snaggletooth Move, MOV. This is a story about an unusual girl who needs to get her teeth fixed at midnight, and it is, really, it's the movie is a Valentine to the horror genre, but also the comedies of the 80s that I grew up with a peculiar twist.
Okay.
I have to say, I'm really excited about this movie. And one of my favorite things about it is that it is a coming of age story about a girl, and it is all about her kicking ass. And I'm really excited to be making this film. We're shooting in January, and the film will be out shortly thereafter. There will be an LA premiere. The date's not set yet, but if you're following us on Instagram and Twitter, you'll know when it happens.
Okay. So this was, would you say that this was a passion project of yours because of it's your way of paying homage to the horror industry and the 80s films?
It's not. Okay. It's become a passion project, but I was, I had a hard time choosing. I'm, sitting in my apartment now, and I have 13 giant post-it notes on the wall with different movie ideas and also the different plot beats for four different feature films across the wall in front of me. And my friends make fun of me for it. And there are a couple stories that I, that are one in particular about my family, which I think is probably true for a lot of, filmmakers. And ultimately I decided I'm not skilled enough yet to tell it the way that I wanted to tell it. So I picked, Snaggletooth, something that I felt that I could really, wrap my head around. That is also, and I'm not a big horror buff, honestly. I mean, I like a lot of horror, but yeah. I'm not like a long time. I can't do an homage to like,
okay,
you know, like Stranger Things, but I've picked it because it has an audience, and there are lots of festivals that really focus on it as a genre. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to really just focus in and you know, make an amazing movie, and hopefully a lot of people will see it. So when I, you know, next year when I start working on a feature, people will say, look, I saw your ridiculous horror movie. What's next? Yeah. I want to be on that picture with you. And so that's in the back of my mind.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Colin. I hope the conversation was good for you. I greatly appreciate you stopping by this evening to, you know, have this conversation with me. What would you like to leave my listeners with? What are your parting words for my listeners?
My parting words, well, first, Jay Lewis, this has been a pleasure having this conversation with you. Just, you know, over the last hour has, you know, changed and enhanced my thinking about, you know, what's happening in America right now, especially in Hollywood, but now in some other industries. So I guess my parting words would be for the people listening to this show, pick up your phone, get that story down. There are gaps to fill, and we need to get out there and tell stories and make movies. And, you know, good riddance to the old guard. The new guard is moving in.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you very kindly. And, you know, every week, you know, I like leaving my listeners myself with a parting comment. And just from our conversation right now, it's like every conversation I have, I can say almost the same thing. You know, just for my listeners, I just really hope that you listening to my show just gives you a different perspective. You don't always have to agree with everything that I say, and I don't want you to. You don't always have to agree with what my guests say. Again, I don't want you to. Just as long as you get a different perspective and just get more to think about. In my introduction tonight, I said we all have a lot to be thankful for. You know, we should be thankful that we do have the ability to live in a country where you can still get along with somebody and not think the same way that they think. So because that is actually a real thing, I would just like for everyone to just put that in your perspective. You don't have to agree with everything everybody says. Now, of course, yes, there's a lot Colin and I agree about. I'm not saying that I disagreed with anything that he said. This is just kind of like my woosah kumbaya Thanksgiving holiday type feel good moment. So I just hope you all have a happy Thanksgiving. Next week, we will have a great show to end the month of November. Stay safe, eat a lot, and I hope that you all are blessed and inspired. Thank you very much for joining us. We are out. Are you inspired? Can I inspire you more? Come join me every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. on Station 2 here at BBS Radio. Let's get inspired together. Come join me. You'll be glad you did.